podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving at your desk, maybe at the gym, but you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach and see a rocket launch or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of the Manners Masterclass series, where each month I will interview one of my favourite cricket personalities for our elite level Patreon subscribers. This episode, I am joined by former Australian captain Lisa Stelaker. Lisa was a champion all-rounder, playing 187 times for Australia across 3 formats, and she became the first female to take 100 wickets and score 1,000 runs in 50-over cricket. Lisa retired from the Australian team on top in 2013 after winning her 4th World Cup in her father's birthplace of Mumbai. Since then, she has become a much-loved commentator and broadcaster across the world. Lisa holds a special place in my heart as she was the first international cricketer to come on the podcast back in 2016 and has always been generous with her time and has given me great support. Let's get into my interview with Lisa Stelaker. Joining me all the way from Chennai is Lisa Stelaker, former Australian captain. Lisa, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, man. It's nice to see your friendly face.
Absolutely, but it's amazing to have you on this show, because you've been on Cricket Unfiltered and the Australian Cricket Podcast quite a few times, but we've never really done a sort of, I don't know, deep dive into your career. And you're someone in the cricket community I really admire because of the way you conducted yourself as a player and your post-playing career. So it's just great to be able to sort of talk to you about your career. Yeah, so thanks for coming on. Obviously, when you first came on the podcast, it was just after you retired a couple of years, and now you've sort of been retired for a while. How's it going in the media?
Yeah, it's going well. I mean, I think last year everyone, regardless of what work or what your passion was, life changed dramatically for everyone. And it was about 6 months I was at home and my family were like, geez, this is the most we've seen you. Off you go. Get back on the road again. So I guess I'm very fortunate now, the fact that cricket is being able to be played, and even though we're all in bio bubbles, the game is being able to be played. And obviously IPL is great, but I had a great summer as well with Channel 7.
And how many bubbles and how many quarantines have you done?
Well, I've done probably 2 bio bubbles. So I don't know, being stuck in Melbourne during Christmas in that period because of the state border closures counts as a bio bubble, but that kind of obviously affected my time back at home. I wasn't able to be in Sydney where I live, but I've done only 2 weeks hard quarantine when I've come back from the last IPL. I literally have left home, I think around the 28th of January, and I haven't come home yet, simply because I don't really want to do the 2 weeks quarantine. So get all the work done and dusted, and then I'll come back home for the Olympics and then obviously the Australian summer. So it's been hard because this has probably been the longest time I've been away, and the world is still really crazy here in India. Things aren't good outside the bio bubble. A lot of my friends are getting COVID. A lot of their family members are getting COVID. So it's scary times. But yeah, I'm fortunate enough to get to call the best T20 domestic competition in the world.
And I'm glad you're not doing multiple quarantines. Just put it off and do it in one hit and binge all your TV series and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the good thing is when I do quarantine here in India, I think it's 6 days. We've got nice rooms. You can order food whenever. You get choices of Western and Indian food. So it's a little bit different when you go home and do government hotel quarantine, so definitely. I can cope with this one.
Good. Now the reason I got you on is because it's been a huge couple of years for you. I mean, you've actually had some serious recognition for your contribution to the game. Firstly, last year, you were inducted into the ICC Hall of Fame, as you know, the 27th Australian, only joining people like Bradman, Border, Tendulkar, Gavaskar, Warne. You know, that's pretty good company. So you just tick off the ICC Hall of Fame. Then earlier this year, you were inducted into the Australian Cricket Hall of Fame in the same class as Johnny Muller and Merv Hughes. Unfortunately, we didn't get the usual sort of Hall of Fame dinner or the award dinner where you get to sort of make a speech, but just a phenomenal recognition for your immense contribution, both when you were playing and post-playing. Tell me, I guess, who lets you know about these things? Do you know, I mean, did the ICC just send you an email, hey, we're putting you in the Hall of Fame? What's it like when you get that bit of news?
I got a call from someone who was actually on the nomination committee saying, Lisa, you've been nominated and it's unanimous, you'll be in the ICC Hall of Fame. And I said, it's a joke, right? It's a stitch up. Seriously, I'm not that young. I mean, I'm not that old, should I say. There are so many more worthy recipients in my eyes. And then I think a week later, I got an email from the CEO letting me know that the ICC Hall of Fame was coming my way. And you're right, the last couple of years has been difficult because normally with the ICC Hall of Fame, you get to fly over business class with someone to the awards, and I think it was going to be in South Africa and I was going to take my father, and it was going to be a nice little trip for us, but unfortunately not to be. And then with Cricket Australia, I was informed by Alistair, the CEO of ACA at the time, because it's a joint committee between ACA and Cricket Australia. So before he left, he rang me and said, look, you know, I've got some really good news. You've been inducted. So again, from my point of view, I've been to these awards, both ICC and Cricket Australia, and you look at the people that are inducted and absolute legends of the game have played an important role. And I guess for me, I see so many other previous female players who weren't afforded the opportunity to play as much as I did, but yet probably more skillful, more talented, and did it a hell of a lot harder than I did. So I guess I feel like a little bit of an imposter because I still feel that there are plenty more other people that need to be recognised. But it certainly is nice to kind of reflect on the recent couple of nominations and inductions with my family. And I guess it means all that hard work and missing out on friends, birthday parties, weddings, birthdays, you name it, have been worth it.
Yeah, and all that training and hard work. It's interesting you mentioned that, you know, you felt like an imposter. Has it kind of sunk in since then a little bit that, you know, you're in, you know, these great Hall of Fames and, you know, you've sort of been able to, I guess, digest everything you've been able to achieve a bit more?
Yes and no, I guess, because the world, we're all just trying to grapple with the world and get things going. So I guess it's kind of in the back of my mind, and maybe because it hasn't been a big ceremony or the awards where you kind of sit down and they kind of do this is your life type thing.
Well, we're doing that now. I'm doing it. I'm doing it for you.
Thanks, Menas. Look, you know, when you look at the list of people inducted into the Hall of Fame, you kind of go, wow, I can't believe that I'm there. So, yeah, I mean, I have when it was happening and when I had to do Zoom chats and for the award ceremony, it was nice to reflect on I guess, people that have been important throughout my development. And you take your time to kind of think of those people, you know, when you were a young child and when they first introduced you to cricket or made you feel accepted within the boys' team or whatever it may be, that everyone's played an important role in my development.
I imagine it must have been a pretty special moment when you told your dad both bits of news.
Yeah, he was chuffed. Like, God bless him. He's always been my biggest supporter. He's always kind of always pushed me to really strive and be the best I could be in whatever I've done in life. So, you know, it was a very proud moment for him. You know, it's funny because my sister doesn't necessarily quite get it all, but, you know, she's just as proud and has always been coming to the grounds to watch me play, even when I came out of retirement with the Sydney Sixers. And my nephew, he's a funny one. He's just like, oh, so what do you get? So, you know, you have three different reactions with my family, which is gold.
What do you get?
So with the ICC, you get a frame and a hat that's framed, and you get a little gold pin that has the hat part of ICC Hall of Fame. And then for Cricket Australia, I think there's just an award that I'm still yet to get. So, yeah, I think right. That's it.
Your mantelpiece will be filling up. Yes. I mean, you spend a lot of time talking about other cricketers' stories in commentary and media. Are you able to sort of comprehend that your story is pretty special, that, you know, you started at an orphanage in India and now, you know, you've reached the peak of both international cricket and now broadcasting. I mean, yeah, do you get why people are drawn to that story?
Yeah, I guess for me, and it's a bit like everyone's life, they kind of go, well, it's just my life. It's just my story. It's not that interesting. Yet mine was always very different to everyone else's, firstly being adopted and immigrating here in Australia at a young age. I've been fortunate enough to be involved in a lot of speaking engagements. So obviously you kind of go through how you started, who kind of put you under their wing, how did you learn the game of cricket when it was really a male-dominated sport back in the 80s and 90s. So, yeah, I tell that story and people are amazed, but like I said, I still think, well, it's just my story. Like, it's just my life. That's just how it is. But, yeah, especially when I come here to India, that they're all always very, very much about saying, well, she's one of ours. You know, she was born in India and, you know, she spends so much time now here in India as well, post-playing days as well. So, yeah, my story is fascinating. It's different. Just like everyone else's, there's a few highs, there's plenty of lows along the way, but it's something that I'm completely proud about because there has been some big hurdles along the way.
Well, you should be very proud. And it's been, I think, really special to just be recognised not only in Australia, but to have that international recognition just shows how much you're appreciated around the cricket community. So, yeah, that's a huge, I'm just so pleased that you got inducted into both Hall of Fames. So sort of going back to the beginning, like when did you kind of fall in love with the game? What was that thing that just twigged?
Yeah, I think like most Australian kids, just played in the backyard, and my father, being born and bred in India, he used to be taken to cricket matches with his father. So everyone here in India follows cricket so much. They are the perfect pundits, really. They live and breathe every statistic and every match, and they can recall things extremely well. So my father had a passion for the game. He kind of would play in the backyard with me. He took us to the SCG when I was young. I remember sitting in the Barongal stand, and you kind of look out over the hill back then and see all of the shenanigans that was going on the hill. And it was a great time because we had friends in Newcastle that would come down, and there was a girl who's still very, you know, I'm still very close to her. So she's 2 years younger than me. We'd get dressed up in the same gear, you know, get bed sheets and ride Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi. You know, all of that stuff that, you know, we all of us love about the 80s and 90s of cricket, going and watching. And back then there was two or three games a summer, you know, Australia were playing, that's it. Like, so it was a big occasion. And I still remember hoping that the SCG matches or even the test match would get sold out so it'd be shown on Channel 9. So,
you know,
yeah. So, you know, so cricket was certainly a passion within my family. I played it. I started playing it at under 10s, but tennis was actually my sport that I wanted to excel at. And it wasn't until I was probably about 12 or 13, I kind of made the switch, because tennis was a lonely sport. it was quite hard, obviously, because it's, you know, there's a lot of stepping stones to get up into the elite level. But I felt it was a very lonely and to a certain extent bitchy sport. So the team sport of cricket drew me in, and probably from around the age of 14 or 15, that's when I thought, right. And that's probably when I also was aware of an Australian women's cricket team, a domestic structure, underage competitions. Whereas when I first started playing under 10s, boys, I didn't even know women's cricket existed.
Do you think playing cricket sort of helped you find your identity in a new country? And do you think there was a bit of that it kind of helped, just, you know, helped that process?
I think being sporty certainly did. I mean, you look at the Australian culture and it's be outdoors, be active. Cricket, tennis, sports, AFL, football, obviously wasn't involved in any of that. But certainly sport allowed me to blend in, and I was fairly good at it. So all the cool kids at school were always really sporty, active, good runners, cross country, all of that type of stuff. And that's the stuff that I wanted to be involved in. So for me, my childhood was one that was positive, that was inclusive, yet for my sister, it was completely different. So it just shows you potentially how Australian culture was back then. You know, they were more accepting of people that fitted into their ways, and anyone that was a little bit different, they were quite quick. School kids were quite quick to bully and tease. So I think sport was my saviour, absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about your sister having a different experience. I mean, well, I guess you said you had a good experience, she didn't. Surely there were small issues when you were playing as a youngster where, even not explicit, but sexism or racism that sometimes people didn't even realise they were doing. You know, how does that make you sort of view Australians at the time?
Yeah, I think to be honest, it was, look, I can't think of any from a racism point of view. I think there was one comment when I was like in kindergarten, and a year two stuck up for me, and that was it. I guess casual racism existed, but the Aussie banter and political correctness was not around in the 80s and 90s. So just the jokes of, Lisa, you can get the bags because you're the helper, or I guess there was one remark, and I wrote about it in the Sydney Morning Herald. It was soon after the Black Lives Matter over in England, and that started to take off. But it was like my teammates kind of pinned me down and wanted to put a bindi on my forehead or a dot, because from an Indian point of view. And I'm like, what? Why are you doing that? Like physically pushing me down on the bed to try and do it. That upset me. Friends used to call me Tabbouleh, Siddiqui, Hummus, and I'm like, well, I'm not even Lebanese, but anything different, awkward, they would say. So that casual racism was there, but, and I probably started to say, oh, hey, I'm the token, you know, I'm the, you know, we're ticking a box with me here in the side. So I used humour as a way to probably protect myself a little bit. And probably get in all of the silly jokes before anyone else could get in. But that, I don't think it, apart from a couple of times which I mentioned about being pinned down, it never really bothered me that much. But when you look back on your time, you're constantly doing it, you're constantly saying it. So I guess that has an effect at the end of the day. Sexism, it's probably, I probably found things a little bit harder, more in the commentary world, because as female broadcasters, we've come in with a different opinion. And obviously at the moment, things that are blowing up, you know, Crick Info is changing the term batsman to batter.
Oh, yes.
And they've also changed a while ago, not man of the match, player of the match. Yep. Yet I still have conversations with my fellow commentators, with executive producers who go, well, men are out there playing, so it's man of the match. What do you guys do in women's cricket? I go, we say player of the match. Like, how, it's not that hard. So I've actually found it more frustrating, the sexism now, because things are starting to change and there's females more heavily involved in the game. Women's cricket is more prominent, yet people are very adamant that we cannot change things. We can't make it more inclusive. And, you know, even just on social media, I put out a tweet saying about this quick info change of batter to batsman to batter. And I said, interesting to note that it's all males that are kicking up a stink and having a go. And it's like, it's not about you. It's never been about you. And I guess my point with the tweet was, don't you want the game to grow? Don't you want more women to be involved? And people saying, well, if just changing batsman to batter is going to grow the game or the women's game, then it's ridiculous. And it's like, you guys are stuck. You put your head in the sand and you just don't want to see your world. And I guess that's probably been the most frustrating thing from a sexist point of view, because you feel like you're just having to have the same conversations again, and it's a constant battle.
It's a hot topic, and I sort of look at it as it's about the young female person that's watching the game on, say, TV or at the ground, and every term's male gendered, and then you're explicitly excluding them from the conversation. Yeah. I think batter is a much better term. I've never seen the problem with it. So, yeah, I totally see where you're coming from. And I think it's just a lack of awareness. People just don't understand what it's like for a young girl to be watching a game where everything's male gendered. Then you feel it's not for you.
Correct. Exactly. And even, you know, people saying, well, why can't you have woman of the match and then man of the match? And I said, and I went back and I said, what do you do about junior cricket when it's mixed teams? Do we forget about grassroots cricket, like where everyone's blending in together? Like, come on, people. Like, just think logically, please. Please. That's all I ask you to do.
Yeah, definitely. And with the stuff about racism, I'm just curious. I felt that Cricket Australia and the Australian cricket team dropped the ball last year when the BLM issue arose, and the team never made an explicit statement about where they stood on it. And at the end of the summer, there was a racism furor at the SCG regarding the Indian cricket team. And I see a direct correlation, because I just don't think the Australian cricket team had enough guts to go, we're going to take our knee at the beginning of the summer to show our solidarity with the issue.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. And obviously I'm involved with the ACA and the Players Association. And I remember speaking to a couple of the male players who were saying they were going to do the barefoot circle. And I said, that's fine, but that is a separate issue to Black Lives Matter. Don't think doing the barefoot circle, you're ticking the Black Lives Matter box, because you're not. I feel like in Australia, and again, it goes back to even terms of player in the match, batsman, batter, predominantly white males do not think about what it's like to be someone else, something different. You know, even speaking to my sister, who's of darker colour than me because she's from South India, she's even commented sometimes she walks into a shop and she feels that she's being judged by how she looks straight away because of her colour. And we're here in the 21st century, and these things are still happening. So, yeah, there was an element, and also I know that there were some differences within WBBL franchises and Big Bash franchises. Some teams wanted to do it, some teams didn't want to do it. And there probably would be a nice correlation for those that are from West Indian or England, where probably Black Lives Matters is more of an issue. It's not necessarily an issue here in Australia, it's more the Indigenous population. That's why I think the Australian cricket team probably felt that they were focusing on what is the issue in this country, but really it is a global issue. The Black Lives movement is a global issue, not necessarily just about Australia. So I think in a certain extent, they didn't quite understand how big an impact the Black Lives Matter was and what they potentially could have done for it.
I also think it's a very naive view to just go, what's our problem here, and not think about the broader issue. A massive cop-out. The barefoot circle was a massive cop-out. No one saw it because it was done, you know, an hour before the game started. And I feel that Cricket Australia, they can't make the players do something, but they did not advise their players well. And I think, you know, it just further plays into this image of Australia being insular and struggling to see past its own issues.
I think the main thing is one thing that was certainly highlighted for me was education on Indigenous issues, but also Black Lives Matter needed to happen more. And there was probably a scurry of, we've got to educate them, at least we can talk to elders and they can instruct the players on reasons why these things are important. But like I said, in Australia, I don't think we had people to turn to educate us on that issue. So you might be right in the saying that, you know, and I guess it's interesting to hear your point of view, because you're a lover of the game. You watch that much cricket. You're across a lot of things, and for you to have those opinions, those strong opinions, hopefully people within Cricket Australia are listening.
Let's hope so. Now back to some playing stuff. What was it like when you got the bag? What?
I said lighter stuff.
Well, yeah, you know, we'll get back to politics maybe. but tell me, what was it like when you got the Breakers call up first off?
Yeah, so I was had just played under 19s national championship and literally got home and got the call up for next weekend to play against Queensland out at Kings Park, out at Parramatta. There were a couple of players, Joe Gary and Ange Farrell, and they had actually been hit by a bus. Jesus. Oh, no, a while ago.
Were you driving that bus?
No, I wasn't driving that bus. But they were hit by a bus, and there was a court case about getting
compensation.
Compensation for it, and so playing cricket, and there was a lot of injuries and things like that. So I kind of got called in halfway through the season. So yeah, it was, you know, it was dreams come true. And it's quite funny because you literally play at Kings Park one weekend and then the next weekend you're playing at the SCG. So kind of really distinct different grounds, but amazing experience to play with players that aren't recognised now, but someone like a Sally Griffith or a Kate Walsh, who were, you know, so much state cricketers, to get my opportunity to play with them was pretty special.
How'd you go in the first game? Do you remember?
Did I get a wicket? Was there rain? One was washed out, I think, okay. The second game. I don't know how I went.
I think as well that you're almost a sort of nice bridge between a few generations almost of cricketers that, you know, when you started the Breakers, they were probably not paid at all, paid to play, taking time off work. Then sort of during your career, you started to at least get expenses paid for. And then by the end of your career, players that you had played with and coached were now being paid to play. I guess, what was the atmosphere like in those early dressing rooms when you've got women that are working, they might have families, you know, it was a real tough slog, I imagine.
Yeah, look, it wasn't a tough slog then when you think about, well, that was what we did. When you now compare it now, you go, I don't know how I did it. But all of us were working full time. So work full time, train twice a week. Tuesday, Thursdays was our training days at the SCG. And then you play weekends and then you go back to work. So there was no nice recovery. You know, you had a coach, you had your manager. I don't even know if we had a physio back then for New South Wales.
Doubt you did.
Yeah.
I remember the New South Wales team like training on grade grounds sometimes. Like,
yeah.
I saw Mossman, the New South Wales Breakers had come in and train there some afternoons.
Yeah, it was all about trying to find venues sometimes, because obviously when the big boys came in town, we were kind of shafted.
Yeah, or like so the under 16 men would get a preference in the nets probably back
then. Yeah, so it was about trying to get those opportunities. I mean, but we loved it. We enjoyed it. We had fun. You kind of looked forward to seeing each other because it was almost a second life. You know, you had your life, your home life, your family life, then you had your work life, and then you had your sporting life. And it was kind of great. I think back then players were, whilst they were stretched, they were more balanced. They didn't have all their eggs in one basket. Cricket was a passion, a love, you know, and if you could represent and play for your state or your country, a huge honour. But that's all it was. You know, it wasn't your job. It wasn't your 9-to-5, you've got to perform well in order to get your pay rise type thing. It wasn't ever hard work. It was things that you wanted to do, that you all your spare time was given to cricket. So, we have fun memories of you'd fly in, you'd get your vans and off you'd chuff to Frankston or out to Colac, and you play on, you had your mum's cooking all of your lunch and, beautiful teas and everything like that. They're the stories that you remember the most, not flying business class, going into five-star accommodation, go to the ground, come back to the hotel and then fly out next. We've got some great stories along the way.
Adversity can bring groups together. It's interesting you talk about, the perspective. And one thing that I think is really evident in the current Australian women's team is that they all have that perspective, because most of them were, started playing when it wasn't a professional game. So they're able to sort of understand that what they do is a privilege and a great job. And, they know how hard a lot of average Australians are doing and what life is like if you're not a professional athlete. So it keeps them grounded. Do you think there's ever a time in, 10 years where that's gone and female players have forgotten that?
I hope not. I think we've got some wonderful people within the Australian women's team, like a Rachel Haynes, a Lisa Healy, who are very aware of the past players and what the struggles were. I mean, and those two players, I played a lot of cricket with them, in National League, like I said, you play on a week and then you fly home and you go back to work type thing. So they've kind of come through those pathways. I hope that, those players pass on and educate the younger ones of what it was like, how hard it was and how lucky they are now, so that they can acknowledge and not necessarily, I think, the main thing is to understand that as female cricketers, I think we have a role in continually educating people about the women's game, being more accessible than probably the male players, to fans, to kids, to grassroots cricket. Go play club cricket when you can. I know Elisa Healy does that all the time. Like, don't put yourself, on this pedestal and forget where you came from. I think that's the main thing. If you can still find ways to give back and do it for free, not ask, well, is this part of my contract? Is this a player appearance? And do it because you want to do it. Do it because you love it. That would be my message to the younger generation. Just don't forget where you came from, and players have given up a lot along the way for you guys to be where you are. So just be kind when you're in those privileged positions.
Well, actually, interestingly, you'd be proud of me. I commentated the New South Wales Premier Cricket Women's Grade Final. And you're right, a lot of the WBBL players came back and played for Northern Districts versus Sydney Cricket Club. Northern Districts got the win in the Women's Premier Cricket Final at Bankstown Oval. But, the current Australian team all have great perspective. And even I think a couple of years ago, Elisa Healy came over to my house with you and recorded a podcast. Yeah. Now, would you get, Tim Payne or one of the Aussie men, male players coming over to my house to record a podcast? Not so sure.
Yeah. I mean, look, I can understand in the men's setup, you get asked a lot.
A lot of demands.
And even now, the female players, even myself, you get asked a lot to be on podcasts. And you try and give yourself time to say, yes, I'll help out. But at some point you can't say yes to everything. So I get that. I do understand that. But so I think the great thing and why women's cricket has grown so much in our country is because people see the Australian women's side as your mates, your friend next door, your neighbour, the person you see in the cafe regularly. And they're just normal human beings. They're not something different. So there's something very relatable with them. And that, I think that has struck a chord with the Australian public. So I hope they never lose that. I hope that aspect still keeps growing, because I think that's one of the best qualities about our Australian women's side.
Well, you'll be around to keep them in line with all your commentary.
I don't know if they'll listen to me, Menace. I'm the old has-been, you know, washed up that just comments on their games now.
yeah, just the multi-Hall of Fame inductee. What about the first game for Australia? Do you remember that, putting on the baggy?
Yep. So I got the call up for the Ashes. My family was so excited because my mum's originally from England. So she came back at the time. She had breast cancer and I think they separated her chemo treatments. So she got to see her mum, which was really good. And first game was in Derby. I remember I got two wickets. One of the wickets was Claire Taylor and it was a juicy full toss and she missed it and it was bowled. So it was very embarrassing. Yeah, so, you know, that was an interesting tour because I'd rolled my ankle before we even flew out to England and I think it was like a grade two. It was a pretty bad one. And then you fly in economy class with Ouch. Your ankle throbbing. It wasn't as nice. But a great tour in the sense that we went to Ireland. We were billeted out in Ireland when we played the games there. So went into family homes and... yeah, some great memories, but I learned then and there that I didn't want to be running drinks very much. So had to work on a lot of things in order to get back in the side and stay in the playing 11. But I remember playing my first few games and I thought I had to play a different brand of cricket or I had to change what I did. And I think all players, when you take that next step up, you feel like you have to change what you're doing. What you've been doing is the reason why you're there. And it takes a little bit of time to figure that out. So, it was, get first call up for an Ashes tour.
Fantastic.
You pinch yourself.
Definitely. And what was your approach to captaincy? How did you sort of look at getting the best out of players?
Yeah. Look, I was fortunate enough to be captained by Belinda Clark, who I still think is the best captain I ever played under. She was always very calm in any situation. And there were, and back then there were times where the New South Wales team should have lost or the Australian team should have lost, but we always found ways of winning. And just her composure on being able to keep things calm. Like you look to your leaders in pressure situations and if they're flapping around, doesn't give you a lot of hope. And I've played under some of those captains, but Belinda was very calm. So I learned that skill from her. I guess from my point of view, I always thought getting to know who the person was away from the field was really important because, as we know, there's so many things that can go on in a person's life and it can affect how they play. So I tried to do that. I tried to ensure that the younger players felt very comfortable coming into the New South Wales setup because, you know, when I first came in, it was as a youngster, you keep your mouth shut, you know, you don't say anything, you sit and you learn. If you say something, you're probably going to get teased. It was that kind of hard school. So I tried to probably change that a little bit and make them feel probably more included than maybe sometimes even the more experienced players.
And did you enjoy that challenge of being the skipper?
I loved it. I actually really enjoyed it because I had always enjoyed the tactical side of the game. I still see cricket as a game of chess. And the captains that are very good are those that can see what the opposition's doing 2-3 moves ahead and be able to combat that. So I certainly enjoyed that aspect. I enjoyed trusting my gut and sometimes it was wrong. Sometimes I got it completely wrong, but I enjoyed the lessons that you could learn being a skipper out there.
I imagine you're a great skipper. I've heard you say that 2009 was a tough year for you. Why are you laughing?
Because it's a year that I want to erase out of my life. But anyway.
Well, what would you, I'm just curious, what would you, if you know, you were talking to a current player, male or female, and they were going through a horror year, what advice would you give them?
I think try and put things in perspective. Try and separate things. So surely there's something going well in your life, but when you put all your eggs in one basket, and 2009 was a year of that because we had a home World Cup and then we had a T20 World Cup and things didn't go very well. Everything kind of rolls into one and it can become all encompassing. But if you try and separate and put things in perspective, you'll be able to find a way out of it. But yeah, 2009 was a challenging year for me personally, but also then from a team aspect, you know, things kind of went off the rails dramatically. We had our worst performance in a World Cup ever. It happened to be the home World Cup as well.
Wasn't the World Cup final played at North Sydney Oval with a few hundred people or something? Far short of the 90,000 we got.
Yeah, to be honest, that was the first. 2009 was the first World Cup that came under the auspices of ICC. So it was the first time that matches were ticketed. We had, you know, you can look at that and go, whoa, that's nothing. But when you look at 2005, when we played it in South Africa, it was still under the International Women's Cricket Council. Soon after that, everyone integrated and women's cricket fell under ICC, the national boards, and then also state associations. So, yeah, first time it was ticketed, first time more than the semifinals and the finals were televised. So we had Danny Morrison, Wasim Akram, Belinda Clark, Mel Jones, I think, did games then. So it was the first time I think 10 games were telecast. So it was all part of the great plan to get up to that 90,000. I guess you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah, it was a stepping stone.
It was certainly a stepping stone. And, yeah, it was a great event in that aspect. Just it was
not on
a
the field.
Terrible tournament for us.
Didn't the Poms win it?
Yeah, the Poms won it because New Zealand seemed to have a psychological barrier when it comes to England. They just can't find ways to beat them.
Just have a psychological barrier to winning finals, male or female. So you retired in 2013, 4 World Cup wins, but, you know, finishing in Mumbai, lifting the World Cup trophy, just a fairy tale finish. Isn't your father from Mumbai or your family? So, I mean, it really was a fairy tale finish, like a lot of your story, even though you're too humble to admit it. But what was it too early? Was 2013, did you retire a few years too early?
Some people may say yes. For me, I would say absolutely not. It was the perfect time. I had probably 18 months prior to that, I wanted to step away from the game. I wasn't enjoying it. Everything just got too hard. You know, you're literally giving up all your annual leave from work to play, and it wasn't fun. So it's like, why even bother do this? But I remember my father was like, no, you should retire when you want, but when you're on top of your game. And I certainly wasn't on top of my game for a number of reasons. And then I had some teammates of mine, Shelley Nitschke and Sarah Andrews, who were good friends, and they said, no, you've got to go. You can't walk away from the game earlier than what you should. You should finish the way you want to finish. And there was a change in coaching staff, and I remember Catherine Fitzpatrick came in, and she rang me up. She said, I'm not going to tell you how to suck eggs. You know how to play the game. I want to get the best out of you. How do we do that? And it kind of probably changed the way I saw it at that point. And there was obviously younger players coming through the ranks. Meg Lanning had just kind of made her debut.
She's okay.
She was okay back then. Elisa Healy was kind of sitting on the sidelines for ODI cricket. And we had two World Cups. So we had 2012 was the T20 World Cup in Sri Lanka, and then 2013 was the 50-over World Cup. And I thought, right, and I'd set my goal, right, 2 World Cups. We'd beaten England in 2011 at Bankstown to regain the Ashes, so which is something that we had lost in 2005. So we had had that, and I thought, right, here's a chance to win T20 World Cup, 50-over World Cup, and then out you go. And so I just told a couple of my close friends, not within the Australian cricket team, and my family, that Mumbai was going to be my last event. Some of them came over. Unfortunately, my family couldn't. But, yeah, the hope and the dream was to play in the final, win the World Cup, be number one in all formats and walk away from the game. The fairy tale was complete. And to take the final catch, a good little diving catch to my right, you know, had really topped it off. And then, what, 40 minutes later, I retired in the change rooms.
Wow. I find it incredible that Cricket New South Wales made you take your annual leave to play for Australia.
Well, Belinda Clark, she was the head of women's cricket for Cricket Australia, and she had to take annual leave to captain her country.
Yeah, just... I know it was a different time, but it doesn't age well. So you retire. I know you missed, you know, your teammates, especially once you retired. You came back for the Sixers, lost a final, won a final, even though you weren't playing in the second final, but still. What was it like coming back after the break?
Look, I was excited because I wanted to play with my mates. I never thought leaving the game I would miss playing with my mates. And obviously, at that stage, Elisa Healy, Elise Perry, Sarah Ailey were three of my closest friends within the side. So when they were with the Sydney Sixers and the Sixers asked me to play, I said, hell yeah, I'm coming back. This looks like a bit of fun. Then it dawned on me, I need to get fit. The game has changed. I wasn't necessarily worried about my skill level, but the fitness aspect. So I spent a lot of time, you know, losing a bit of weight, getting running again, doing all of those type of things. Because in my mind, I had played the game at a certain level. And if I was coming back, I wanted to be able to still be able to execute my skills the way I did. So, yeah, it took a bit of time, but, yeah, it was an enjoyable first year. Losing the first six games wasn't ideal. And I remember going, I didn't come out of retirement for this. So we were able to change it around, and it was one of the great stories of WBBL.
Yeah, is there a little bit of you, not sort of from an envy point of view, but just wonders what it had been like for you if you've been able to play in an era where you can really find out how good you can be?
Yeah, I had said actually to Tracy a couple of years ago, I said, I wonder if I could have coped in this era, you know, literally cricket, 7 days a week, fitness levels have to be at, you know, an extreme level, monitored everything that you do. You know, I have said I don't think I would have been able to cope. But she and a few others have told me, they go, you would have adapted to it. And I guess it would have been nice to see what I could have achieved if I wasn't trying to fit in a full-time job, training around that. I mean, and I was one of the fortunate ones because I was working at Cricket New South Wales. So at lunchtime, I could go down and use the gym, whereas some people didn't have access to gyms, you know, at their workplace. So, it would have been nice to see what I could have achieved, because I think physically I would have been a hell of a lot better. And what that would have done to my performances on the field, I guess we'll never know.
I think you would have excelled. Yeah, the competitive juices, they're so prevalent.
Look, that doesn't change. The competitive juices, it doesn't matter if you're full-time or part-time. That was at its extreme levels.
Mm. I guess last year you're at the T20 World Cup win by the Australian women's team, almost 90,000 people. You've said you sort of had tears backstage.
No, I was bawling. I was bawling.
Bawling. Why were you bawling? Was it just, yeah, tell me. I'm curious.
Well, I had done the pre-show out there on the ground for obviously the coverage, and then I was thought, right, the teams are lining up for the anthems. Great time to get a good shot, you know, good for Instagram, Twitter, thinking social media. And then the anthems start to play. And I start to well up, and because I have actually good friends within the Indian side, and I know them, I know some of them really well. And, you know, I was really happy for them to come in and play in the final. Then the Australian anthem starts and I just start bawling. And then I see Elisa Healy and Elise Perry looking at me laughing. And I'm going, typical idiots, you know, they're in this wonderful position. But why I was crying was I think where the game had come from, I never thought that I would see that in my lifetime or as quickly as it happened. It was always a hope and a dream. I had bumped into so many past players, volunteers, club cricketers that had flown down and made the trip, going, I want to be here for this moment. And when when ICC and Cricket Australia in 2016 said they wanted to hold the World Cup final at the MCG, everyone was like, really? Like, aren't we biting a bit too much off? Like, surely let's go to a smaller ground and pack that out. But to see it happen and everything that had happened along the way, yeah, emotions just got to me. It was a special moment, probably one of my best moments. If you think of all the things that I've done on the field, I think you would say anyone that was there, that would be high on their list.
Yeah, amazing night. You were a trailblazer on the field, but also trailblazer off the field. Even in retirement, you just keep yourself so busy. I think, in my humble opinion, you're one of the most complete cricket commentators in the world. You can do everything: men's cricket, women's cricket, white ball cricket, red ball cricket, one day competitions. Did you love commentating?
My first opportunity was actually 2010, and I did five overs in between Mark Nicholas and Tony Gregg. It was the ACA All-Stars versus Australia. That's the game where Tim Payne broke his finger. So as soon as I did five overs there, I was like, geez, this is pretty good. How do I get a gig here? So from 2010, I had always wanted to branch out and go into commentary. And back then there were no females involved at all, no women within any broadcast that I was aware of or that I had seen or heard. So I guess from then on, I tried to get an understanding of it, obviously still playing. I was quite happy to be mic'd up. I think one of the first games that the Australian women's side were mic'd up, I was mic'd up whilst I was bowling. Quite happy to have a conversation with Slats and Tubby and Heels in the commentary box. And so I started to kind of get my relationship going with these type of people, thinking whenever I retire, be great to go into that. So when I retired, even before I retired, I think ABC Grandstand gave me an opportunity to, and they were commenting on the Big Bash. So again, got a chance within radio and they gave me a chance even when I retired to kind of step into radio a bit more and cover men's cricket. And the thing was that, I saw it as firstly a great way to still be involved in the game. I thought it was a very privileged position to be able to talk, discuss, share stories, what's happening to the public. I felt also that as a female, I'd never growing up heard a female talk about the game, but yet I was still a passionate fan. Why couldn't a women's opinion, why couldn't that be expressed? And then I thought it was a great way to keep educating people on women's cricket, because if I'm there, I'm going to talk about the women's game. I'm going to reflect on my experiences, which is all women's cricket. And I thought that was a great chance. So as soon as I got the opportunity, I was like, how do I make this a full-time gig? And I guess I'm pinching myself now that I get to travel around the world and be part of some amazing tournaments. And I've met so many wonderful people. But I enjoy watching cricket first and foremost, like you, Menas, and I know what you're like. I'll have the Shield being played, through my TV, or if there's Zimbabwe playing Ireland, it would probably be in the background whilst I'm doing some other work. So I'm very comfortable and happy to watch cricket. And now that I know all of these commentators that I hear, I've gotten to know them a bit more and I enjoy listening to them and the banter, and because I know them personally now as well. So, yeah, it's a great gig. And, I know that I'm not going to be everyone's cup of tea. I learned that pretty quick. People have had to get used to the female voice. I've had to figure out what style or what my style is. Maybe I'm still trying to figure that out. It is an art form. It is a skill. As you know, Menas, it's not that easy just to keep talking about the game and keep adding insight to whatever the pictures are. But one thing I could tell you is I try hard in the sense that I my preparation for every game is really important. I believe in numbers, in adding to the pictures, telling a bit more about the person. So I definitely do my research and hopefully I've brought a different aspect into the commentary box.
Yeah, I've seen that thick book of stats and facts before your commentary. But I just think that like when you were playing, you've actually, you know, carved a path for female commentators to follow. And it's not just you, it's also Alison Mitchell and Mel Jones. You know, it would have been really easy for all of you female commentators to get discouraged because, you know, if we're speaking frankly, some ex-male cricketers get a pretty easy ride into the commentary box. But it hasn't been the same for, you know, you and your other female commentators. So, you know, just having that persistence and sticking at it, I mean, that's a quality that I just don't think should go unnoticed.
I think firstly, we're all very supportive of each other. We have a WhatsApp group and it started with, you know, 4, 5, 6 commentators. Now I think it's up to about 20 around the world, females involved in the game heavily from a broadcasting point of view. So it's been great to see that we keep adding to that list. Well, you know, you've got people that are willing to get in the trenches with you, and that's really important, even though, to be honest, we're actually fighting for the one position against it. Like, all of us are going for that one female broadcast in most of the coverages. So the fact that we're all quite close in that sense and supportive is a good sign. I think that's probably the most important thing. But the other thing as well is we've also felt that if we do a good job, and maybe it's our naivety as well sometimes, I've always felt if I do a good job, then rewards will come my way. That's not necessarily how it works in the broadcast world, because it might be your look, it might be the sound of your voice, it may be how many commentators have we got from Australia or India or England. It's not necessarily just the best commentators get the gig. It's how it's all made up. So, you keep your head down, you do your job well, and you hope you get your next gig.
Well, not only do I hope you get your next gig, but you're inspiring, you know, young female broadcasters. Like when you're playing, you can't be what you can't see. And
yeah,
it's really clear the broadcasts are changing all around the world, and you've been a big part of it.
You watch Menace, when all of these next generation of players finish, they'll go straight into commentary. I'll be like,
already are.
Anyone want to hire me, please? Please, anyone?
Remember Lisa? Lisa Healy's already.
Remember me, please.
That's it. Well, look, we're running out of time. I just got a couple of things to wrap up. I know you've got a lot to do. Two things that you're on the board of, the Australian Cricketers Association. Let's start there. You continue to give back to the game through that. What are you passionate about on the board of the Australian Cricketers Association? What's your thing?
I think there's still a lot of great work that needs to be done. I think the relationship between ACA and CA is probably at its best, at its peak, and I think for the game to move forward positively, both organisations need to work together, not against each other. I guess the thing that I'm most passionate about is, I think domestic cricketers, male and female, we need to make sure that we're looking after them. I certainly feel our international teams are well looked after financially. There's still areas to go within the women's game anyway, but the next level down is going to be important for the longevity of the success of both of our Australian teams. And I'm also on the International Players Association board, FICA. And that's probably being more involved in trying to ensure that women's cricket is part of the conversation when it comes to International Players Association. So New Zealand Players Association, South Africa, England, West Indies. And obviously, Australia has probably the best model, we've seen how it has worked really well. So to be able to kind of pass on that learnings to the other players associations is really important. And then I'm fortunate enough to be part of the player representative on the ICC Women's Committee. So, you know, there's some interesting decisions that
you're not doing.
Well, when you get older, you know, you've got more time, don't you?
Well, it sounds like you've got less time. I imagine being on FICA must be eye-opening and challenging, all these from different areas of the world. I mean, we take for granted in Australia how, you know, far the women's game is, how quick it's moving. It must be sort of different going and seeing other parts where it's not moving.
Yeah, it is, and it's somewhat frustrating. I mean, I'm here at the moment in India, and the Indian women's side just played for the first time since the T20 World Cup final, and they're still kind of scratching their heads what's coming up, even though things have been announced, dates haven't all necessarily been locked, and camps, and they don't have a head coach, and so you kind of go, come on, guys, just invest a little bit more money, invest a bit more time or resources. But that goes to, you know, I think from my point of view, I want as many people having access to the game. I want as many women being given the opportunity to play. And I want to see the game at the end of the day being seen equally by the general public. When that will happen, we're certainly on the right path, but there are a lot of stepping stones in between that and the final goal.
Oh, yes. Well, last thing I want to talk about before I let you go is the Chapel Foundation. I know it's an issue really close to your heart. I'm going to the Chapel Foundation dinner on the 12th of May. I've been to the last two. And also Greg Chapel is going to be the next guest on this podcast. You know, I just, one thing I notices me about, what sticks out to me with the Chapel Foundation is all the money goes to the right places. It's such a lean run, all volunteers. You know, I think Tim Payne's the speaker at the dinner this year, and a lot of money will be raised there. You know, what sort of drew you to that organisation?
I guess I've been fortunate enough to have worked alongside or been mentored by all of the Chapels. So Trevor Chapel used to coach the Gordon women's side. Obviously, Greg Chapel, in his role within Australian cricket, even early on, he was into probably sports psychology before it became what it is now. And my father was a sports psychologist. So I remember they used to have wonderful discussions about visualization, mental rehearsal, goal setting, all of that type of stuff. And then Ian Chapel, as I kind of came out of my career, I'd ring him up and I'd ask him for some tips and can he spend some time listening to some of my stuff? But then obviously hearing Greg's story, and maybe because of my background as well, being part of an orphanage and understanding that having a supportive group around you, a loving family or friends is really important to young adults. And the fact that there is a huge amount of young adults living on the street or couch surfing or living in their cars in a country like Australia is something that probably needs to be addressed. So, you know, to be involved with the Chapel Foundation has been eye-opening because I've learnt a lot more about youth homelessness. But also we do some pretty cool work. Like we don't have the answers to fix it, but we certainly help organisations who are making a big impact. And what also drew me to the organisation is there is no overheads. There's no CEO. Even as board members, when we go to dinners, we have to pay ourselves. We don't get a free seat for our time. But it's a good group of people, an eclectic group of people that I really enjoy spending time with and trying to make a bit of a difference.
We'll head to thechapelfoundation.com to find out more about that. If there's tickets left to the dinner at the SCG, May 12th. You also time it so when they do their winter sleep out, you're usually not here. So
I did it last year, actually, Menes. Thank you very much.
Okay. One out of four or something. Well,
two out of, so I've only missed one. Thank you.
Okay. I'll retract that last comment. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for your time on the Menes Masterclass. I really admire you. Obviously, you know, I met you in my cafe many years ago and you were the first guest ever on my podcasting journey, but you're an inspiration. So thank you very much. And I look forward to seeing what's next.
Thanks, Menes. I've enjoyed seeing your development in the podcast world, going from one in upstairs in your little studio that you set up with all the animals to now what you're doing. You've done a great job and you certainly provide the general public a lot of great information. I mean, I remember coming to do some of your podcasts and all of the information you'd give me was great insight and information. So when I would commentate in the next day or two. So you've done a wonderful job, and all the best for everything that you do as well.
Well, thank you, Lisa. Hopefully we'll get to commentate sometime together.
That would be a bit of fun, wouldn't it, Menace?
Yeah. It might be grey cricket or something, but you never know. I might get the call up.
I know. You do Shield. Speak to the Shield guys and ask them if I can come for a game.
Well, Lisa, thank you. Enjoy the rest of the IPL, and hopefully we'll catch up when you're back in Australia.
Great. Thanks, Menace.
Well, what a wonderful discussion with Lisa. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. For the next edition of Menace Masterclass, I will be joined by former Australian captain Greg Chappell.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving at your desk, maybe at the gym, but you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach and see a rocket launch or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.